Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. In 2014, a coalition comprised of Walk San Francisco, the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition, and 35 community-based organizations worked with the city to adopt Vision Zero, a strategy to respond to the alarming number of traffic accidents resulting in injury or death. Vision Zero's ambitious goal was to reduce that number to zero by 2024 through a combination of engineering, education, and enforcement. When the plan was first adopted, its advocates were confident that a focused effort could result in safer streets. And in initial years, traffic fatalities did indeed decline. In 2017, the number of traffic deaths fell to 20, lower than it had been in years. But since then, the numbers have begun to rise. In 2018, 23 people died in traffic accidents, and so far this year, 22 lives have been lost. This past August alone, a third pedestrian was struck by a car and killed on San Francisco streets in less than a month. And that's when Supervisor Matt Haney introduced a resolution declaring a state of emergency for traffic safety. Why has it been so challenging to reduce traffic deaths despite years of efforts by those involved in the Vision Zero program? And what is being done to turn things around? Joining me in the studio to discuss these issues is a collection of advocates and policymakers. First, we have Megan Weir. She's Director of the Program on Health, Equity, and Sustainability at the San Francisco Department of Public Health and co-chair of the Vision Zero Task Force. Welcome, Megan.
Thanks so much. It's really an honor to be here.
And next, we're joined by Marta Lindsay. She's Communication Director at Walk SF, San Francisco's only pedestrian advocacy agency since 1998. Welcome, Marta.
Thank you. Really glad to be here.
And finally, we're joined by Roger Rudick, editor of Streets Blog San Francisco. Streets Blog is a daily news source that covers the movement to transform our cities by reducing dependence on private automobiles and improving conditions for pedestrians, cyclists, and transit riders. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you, Joseph. I appreciate it.
And of note, Tom McGuire, interim director of the SFMTA, was originally scheduled to appear on tonight's show with our guests, but ultimately was unable to be here tonight. And I want to make sure to invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation as always. We'd like to hear from you about your experiences as pedestrians, as cyclists, as motorists. And we'll be opening our phone lines in about 20 minutes, but I'll give you that phone number now. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us now at cityvisions@kalw. Post a comment at the KLW website or on our Facebook page. And we're also on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. So Megan Weir of the San Francisco Department of Public Health and co-chair of the Vision Zero San Francisco Task Force, I wanted to start with you. I outlined in broad strokes why San Francisco adopted Vision Zero, but tell us a little bit more about the history of how it came to be.
Sure. I work with the health department in San Francisco, and San Francisco has really historically approached Vision Zero as a coordinated interagency and collaborative city response to a public health crisis on our streets. So Vision Zero is really the city's policy and commitment to eliminating those traffic deaths, working with SFMTA, the police department, with the leadership from our mayor's office and our board of supervisors, and of course our key community partners, including Walk San Francisco and the Bicycle Coalition. But Vision Zero is also really a transformative shift in how traffic death and injury is approached in the United States. So traditionally, it's been a very individual-focused approach to traffic safety, something that traffic deaths being kind of an inevitability of our transportation system. And Vision Zero really takes the perspective of traffic deaths are preventable, and we need to create a transportation system that protects the most vulnerable on our system. And that includes people walking and people biking, people in our city who are transit dependent and need to walk to get to where they need to go. But also Vision Zero really focuses a lot on speed. So we know that speed is the leading predictor of whether or not someone survives a crash. Just 5 miles per hour over a 25-mile per hour speed limit can almost double the likelihood of someone dying while they're walking. And so a lot of our coordinated Vision Zero efforts have really focused on how do we slow speeds on San Francisco streets to save lives? How do we invest in targeted improvements in our city's infrastructure to save lives? And one of the other things that I do in my role as Vision Zero is lead a data systems team of epidemiologists and data analysts at the health department to ensure that we have the most comprehensive data to inform our Vision Zero efforts. And one of the tools that we have that our city family uses to inform Vision Zero is what we call our Vision Zero High Injury Network. And that network is 13% of San Francisco's streets, where 75% of our severe and fatal crashes occur. And so that's become a really important tool to inform where the city is investing in safety improvements to save lives. And we know Vision Zero is an ambitious goal, but we also know it's the right goal. So from a public health approach, how can we bring the best data and evidence to the table to help achieve that goal?
Great. I wanted to follow up on a couple of points you just made. The first being that 13% of the streets account for 75% of the deaths and injuries, or just deaths?
Deaths. And Vision Zero focuses not only on deaths, but also to severe injuries. And
okay.
It's to everyone using our transportation, so people walking, biking, and people motorcycling and driving. But through our partnership with Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, we're actually able to use hospital data to identify the most severely injured as well.
And where are those 13% of streets distributed, or how are they distributed across the city? Do they tend to cluster in certain areas, or are they kind of all over the place?
Sure. So we definitely have concentrations in the northeast quadrant of our city, the Tenderloin and south of Market. Definitely have a disproportionate share of where those streets are. These streets are, you know, given the correlation of speed with death, these streets are our busy arterials where we have fast-moving traffic that often intersects with where people are walking and biking.
One-way traffic, too?
One-way traffic is definitely another factor that we've seen. But also it's important to note that there's high intersection with these streets and also what we call our communities of concern. So these are communities where we have more communities of color, low-income populations, seniors, people with disabilities. This high injury network is on fast-moving streets that are through these communities.
And so tell us a little bit more about what this epidemiological engine is telling you about who is likely to be, you said a little bit about this, but say a little bit more about who's likely to be injured or killed. And then who is, what's the profile of the type of vehicle or type of driver? And when I mean that, I mean like private versus commercial versus mm-hmm. public transit, let's say,
mm-hmm.
That are the ones who end up doing the harm.
Mm-hmm. So when we look at who's being injured on our streets, definitely with particularly with respect to fatalities, but also severe injuries, pedestrians comprise about 2/3 of fatalities annually.
And the other third would be cyclists?
Actually, the other third is cyclists, motorcyclists, motor vehicle drivers. There's approximately 1 to 3 cyclists have been killed in recent years. Motorcyclists have become a growing population of those who are severely injured. And right now we don't have good categorization to determine if you're on a moped, a motorcycle, et cetera. So that's something that we're looking into more. But another key factor when we look at our fatalities, our seniors are definitely more vulnerable. And that's true in San Francisco. That's true across the country. If you're older and you're injured in a crash, you're more likely to die just because of your, you know, inherent physical vulnerability. So about every year, approximately 40 to 50% of the pedestrians that are killed are seniors who are walking on our streets.
Hmm. And then say more about the people who, or the types of vehicles who are causing these injuries and deaths.
Yeah, I mean that's a really good question. We definitely have not. It's more private vehicles that we are seeing. We just started, so through the great partnership we have with the hospital, the police department, we just modified the police form to start being able to capture whether or not Uber or Lyft or transportation network company car was involved in a crash. So that's something that we're working to improve our tracking on.
Okay, so you don't have quite as granular detail as to the makeup of the types of vehicles or what their purpose is on the streets at this time.
Exactly.
Okay, and then one last thing about who gets injured. How about scooters? Scooters are everywhere these days. They're often more so, it seems, on the sidewalks than in the streets, but not always.
Mm-hmm.
How have scooters either contributed to accidents or become at risk?
Mm-hmm. So again, through our Vision Zero partnership with the hospital, we were in a good position to begin tracking e-scooter involved crashes last year when the sharing vehicles were released on our city streets. We just released our severe injury report for last year and partnered closely with SFMTA's permitting program to track these injuries. Last year, we had seven severe injuries from people injured while riding scooters or in a crash with a scooter. One critical injury was to someone walking who was injured by a scooter. So far, those are the numbers. We do anticipate that is an underreporting because this is an emerging, this is an emerging mode. We're all learning about that. But through our partnership with the hospital, we're, I think, in a good position to continue to track that data and share that data to inform efforts to prevent injury.
Great. So that was Megan Weir, and she's with the San Francisco Department of Public Health and also co-chair of the Vision Zero San Francisco Task Force, giving us an overview of Vision Zero and a little bit of the data that helps us understand what are the risk factors and to help target efforts. I want to turn next to Marta Lindsay with Walk SF, who was one of the 37 plus advocacy groups who helped bring Vision Zero to be. Tell us what you and your coalition were interested in trying to do when this first was an idea, and tell us how it's gone and where we are today.
Sure. And I actually want to start with something that was said right at the beginning, not to give you a hard time already, but traffic accident. That term itself is a problem, and it's something we really are trying to educate people about, and I feel like it has such a direct connection to the idea of Vision Zero. Which is, when you say accident, it's like, oh, it happens, right? People are just going to get hit and killed on our streets. And Vision Zero is very much, no, that is not an acceptable approach. No loss of life is acceptable. And we can take this preventative approach. And building on what we just heard about with the trends where you know where certain streets are really dangerous and that you get ahead of that, you'd redesign those streets, you do the enforcement to change what's happening on those streets so that the crash doesn't happen in the first place. And I think that is at the heart of, you know, what we have hoped for and why we were pushing for Vision Zero for the city to adopt this as a strategy 5 years ago was this reactive approach to traffic deaths. It's not working. It's not, you shouldn't have to wait till someone is critically or fatally injured to change a street. We got to get ahead of that. We know, I mean, thanks to the great work of the Department of Health, we know where this is happening. And I think all of us who are walking and biking and driving in the city, like we know where those pain points are. And a lot of it's downtown, but there's many other parts of the city too that are incredibly dangerous. And you see close calls all the time, or you see ones that are underreported, speaking of underreporting, because what Megan's looking at is the severe and fatal ones. But then you have all the crashes happening that don't meet that criteria. The police may not have been called, or I'm not sure what it, if it doesn't go to General Hospital, we know people are getting hit all the time. And that number to me is just so maddening and heartbreaking for San Francisco. Like, what kind of city are we going to be? And I think that's the origin of Vision Zero, too. And what was happening 5 years ago, like we're seeing right now, is some real heartbreakers of traffic crashes. And we lost two children in just crossing the street in a crosswalk, 100% following the law, and were hit and killed. And we just shouldn't have to wait for that to happen to do more and to embrace this different way, because we know it's possible, because cities around the world are doing it. And this started in Sweden in the 90s, taking this really aggressive approach to the street design, the enforcement piece, to say that a different way is possible. And so we want that way here in San Francisco.
So why don't you outline for us kind of what the three major areas of approach are and what progress has Vision Zero made in those? And what I mean by that is the engineering, the education, and enforcement.
Right. So a big part of it is street design. And again, I think you don't have to go get a transportation planning degree to experience the streets and see where things aren't working and why someone may be extra vulnerable. And again, we know from other cities, we know from things that are happening in San Francisco, good things, that when you change a street design, it can make a huge impact on both the visibility of everyone on the street, especially pedestrians and bicyclists, giving them space, protecting that space. But also, you make and I know Roger's going to have lots of great ideas about this. You can design a street to make people drive more safely. When you have a like we were talking about the one ways that already came up. When you have a one way, cars are like, woohoo, let's do it. Like, we're going to blaze down this. This road is for us only. And the behavior, there's behavior that comes with that and risk for all of the people who are on those streets. And that's really true in the Tenderloin. And it's just incredibly dangerous conditions for the pedestrians. You can make it, first of all, one way is our problem. But you can also, just by narrowing a lane, immediate driver behavior change. Just by feeling like your car is crowded in a lane is going to slow a car down. The way you design a corner, that shapes how the driver takes the turn, how fast they go. So all those things, you add up the whole suite of wonderful tools out there to design a street for safety. That's a huge piece of the pie or the puzzle, whatever. That's number one. And then we've got the enforcement piece, which I could talk all day about, because we know that enforcement of dangerous driving behavior has plummeted in the city in the last couple of years. And, you know, there's been some commitments to bring that back up, and that's essential. I mean, I think we've had many people say it feels like the Wild West out there in terms of enforcement. No one ever sees enforcement of dangerous driving behavior. So that's got to change. But we also know that the police can never be everywhere at every moment of the day, especially in a city as busy as ours is and as fast as it is growing, which is why we need to bring in the technology piece of speed safety cameras. That's a huge, huge thing in the whole other conversation we could have here. But that's where we have to go, is we need all these tools, this whole suite of things, if we're really going to change what our streets feel like. And San Francisco could be the place where that happens. I believe that. I mean, what a perfect place to the 7x7 miles that we could make truly an exemplary city in the United States for sane streets. I don't know, you know, sane, safe streets that are really wonderful to be in. And there, I mean, Market Street, that's what's next. I hope we can talk more about that.
We'll talk about that. Let's wrap it up with education.
Education. I don't know. Education is one that is a piece of the puzzle, but I don't think there's a lot of, we don't yet know of really proven approaches with mm-hmm. the education. And I think we have a real challenge in San Francisco in that there's constantly more new drivers coming into mm-hmm. our city. So how do we deal with that?
Well, that's a great point, because I wanted to get back to that. But first, I wanted to get your take on the fact that from 2014 to 2017, there was a decline. And now since 2017, there's back an uptick in injuries and deaths on San Francisco streets. What do you think contributed to the downward trend? And what do you think is contributing to the fact that that's kind
right.
of, we're getting a setback?
Yeah,
there.
I think there's I think if you took severe traffic crashes and added in fatal ones, we would see that the numbers have not changed really. Mm-hmm. So I think
so it's the way the numbers are counted.
Yeah, I mean, the severe crashes is the same. And so even though we saw that little dip with fatal crashes and then it's come up again, I don't know what to make of those numbers. I don't know. I'm not an analyst in that way of like what, but I do think we also have had 5 years where we've had a lot more traffic in our city, a lot more delivery vehicles, new challenges.
A lot more pedestrians perhaps, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's the population has increased. That's what I wonder too. What do you think, Megan, in terms of what does the data tell you?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, the city has invested in a lot of the Vision Zero improvements that Marta outlined with respect to really targeted engineering improvements on our high injury network. And we did see, you know, the historic 100-year lows in traffic and in traffic deaths in 2017 and 2018. I think it's really important when looking at these numbers to also the bigger context is exactly what you're talking about. We're seeing increases in population. We're also seeing increases in driving, particularly among transportation network companies. We're also seeing an aging population, in the Bay Area overall, and this is a population that's more vulnerable to traffic death on our streets. So I think as the city's making these targeted, evidence-based improvements, we have a confluence of factors that's making it even more challenging. And that's why for Vision Zero, with our action strategy this year, we've really focused more on some what we're calling it transformative policies that could really make some system-wide change, including automated speed enforcement, as well as urban speed limit lowering, as well as congestion pricing are some examples of those types of tools that we know are really needed to move the needle in the direction we need to go.
I want to reintroduce the program quickly and then get Roger Rudick in on this conversation. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing Vision Zero, the plan to decrease traffic deaths and fatalities in San Francisco to zero by 2024. It's not looking so good, I'll tell you that. With our guests, Megan Weir, co-chair of the Vision Zero San Francisco Task Force, Marta Lindsay, communications director at Walk SF, and in a moment we'll hear from Roger Rudick, editor of Streets Blog San Francisco. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. How safe do you feel walking or cycling in San Francisco? Are you a fan of the changes you've seen or hear about that's trying to make our city streets safer for pedestrians and bicyclists? We invite you to join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can email us now at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at the KLW website or on our Facebook page, and we're on Twitter at cityvisionsKALW. So, Roger Rudick with Streets Blog SF, I presume you were not part of the coalition that put Vision Zero together. Is that right?
No.
You're outside of the group that Marta and Megan are a part of. So what a great position for you to give us your take on how Vision Zero was adopted. Were the goals and the right ones, and why hasn't it done what it's promised to do?
I mean, of course, the goals are noble, and we support them fully at Streets Blog. And Streets Blog is actually an organization. We have blogs in different cities, so I have kind of a national and an international perspective to some degree. Into that question about why it hasn't succeeded in San Francisco up to this point, I don't think we're trying. The people in this room are trying. I don't mean to cast aspersions here, but I think what happens is every time we start to make some fixes on our streets to make them safer, and we certainly know what to do. I mean, Marta touched on one of them, just something as simple as going from one-way to two-lane neighborhood streets, narrowing the lanes a little bit, which kind of forces motorists to slow down and take things a little more cautiously. We start in that direction. One of the things I write about a lot are the implementation of protected bike lanes. We put quite a few of them in the SoMa neighborhood. I know the people in this room are aware, but back in April, we had a cyclist killed on Howard Street where they'd put in a protected bike lane. The protected bike lane began at 6th. Just before that intersection, a motorist didn't look, threw her door open. The cyclist was coming at that very moment, got thrown off her bike or evaded, I don't think we actually know for sure, and ended up under the wheels of a truck and was killed. Now, she was, I don't know, maybe 20 feet from the start of the protected bike lane on Howard. The protected bike lane that was there already was put in because a cyclist had been killed the year before. If I'm remembering it, there's been so many of them, it's actually getting very hard to keep track of them all. So MTA extended that bike lane. I think it's down to 4th now, but it still doesn't go to the Embarcadero. And to me, the reason we're not moving towards Vision Zero is we still have this reactive approach that Marta was talking about that we need to get away from, which is someone gets severely injured. Actually, we usually don't even respond when it's a severe injury. We seem to only respond when it's a horrible death. So we fix a few blocks. We fix an intersection here or there. We don't go all the way. There's pushback about losing parking, about losing loading zones, or we have a situation where we build very wide bike lanes, but we still make it possible for cars to drive into them, especially at the intersections. So we don't go all the way. So it shouldn't be surprising as the population goes up, as the economy does well, as fuel prices do their little permutations and people drive more and less, that we'll see changes in the rate of injury. But we don't get that steady reduction in serious crashes because we're just not doing it. What my publication, what I write about all the time is trying to push our government, not just in San Francisco, but in the rest of the Bay Area, to go all the way and to say, hey, we really want to live in a city where you can cross the street without getting run down by a hit-and-run driver, which just happened last week over in Oakland on Foothill, just a few blocks from where someone had been killed just a few months before. So Oakland, which follows the same pattern, fixed one intersection. They did an emergency treatment where they put bollards in, they narrowed the crossing distance, they improved the crossing, and that was it. And then someone got killed a few blocks down the street from there. So
Those
treatments were not put in yet. So I suppose they'll fix that one now. This is just not, you know, it'd be as if we know how to solve these problems. We've seen it done in Europe, for example. I've spent a lot of time in the Netherlands, and I've seen these treatments that work extremely well. It's almost as if I was just thinking about this today. We invented a cure for polio and treated one patient at a time with a vaccine. It's like we know how to vaccinate these intersections, and we're just not doing it. Instead, we're reacting. And I don't know how to fix this anymore. I mean, I keep writing these stories, and we're all pushing, and everyone in this room is working really hard. But so far, it isn't happening, and I hope we'll make some breakthrough. I have a lot of hope with our mayor. She seems to be very committed to getting some of this done, and we'll see what happens.
So you mentioned some of it already, but what do you think are the major barriers to having these initiatives implemented in a quick and widespread way?
Well, you know, I'm thinking about a crash that I know Marta and Megan are very familiar with, and that's the 12-year-old boy who was run over. As far as I know, he was literally run over by a drunk driver in the Tenderloin who made a fast right turn. Obviously, he was inebriated. We don't call that an accident. That's an inevitable outcome of someone driving around under the influence. But I remember I went to that corner, and I was just astounded. Most of the people that I saw were walking, yet nearly all of the space on the streets was dedicated to cars on one-way streets, permitting them to go as quickly as possible. That corner where the driver turned, if it had been in the Netherlands, and they actually did a test treatment like this over in Oakland recently, which seems to be working, they would have put, it's a little difficult to describe on the radio, I've been thinking for a while how to do this, but at the corner you put a bollard, a solid object that forces that car to come up to the turn. And you really got to slow down and make that turn carefully, or you're going to crash into the bollard.
So instead of like sort of hugging the curb, the curb, you kind of have to make a two-step turn.
That's right.
Because it's a 90-degree turn.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think everyone in the Bay Area is familiar with this. It's kind of an American engineering pattern. We have lanes that kind of, we either have slip lanes or have these really gradual turns to get as many cars through as quickly as possible. Like, well, you'll succeed in getting as many cars through as quickly as possible, but people are going to get hurt and killed. That corner, even though the motorist was drunk, you know, and I've talked to MTA officials about this so many times, if there'd been a good chunk of concrete right there in the corner to do what I was describing, to what we were just talking about, well, the motorist would have hit it instead of a child. Now, the pushback comes, and I've had city officials say this to me, well, we'll get sued. I mean, what do you mean you'll get sued? Well, a motorist will take that turn and they'll damage their car and they'll sue us. And I'm like, so get sued. You know, we're talking about a car going to the body shop. And if the city has to challenge us in court, then do it. But I would rather see 20 or 30 cars a year take a trip to the body shop than one child get run over. And, you know, I hate to say this, but we live in a country, in a city, where it seems like a lot of people in government don't have those values. And that's certainly what I'm hoping to push, is that's got to be the values that people bring to traffic engineering. And that just isn't it, at least not with most of the people in charge that I've met and I've discussed this with.
So Marta Lindsay and Megan Weir want to hear your thoughts about, you know, are the values not there? Is the determination not there? Is there still hesitation because of concerns over lawsuits or pushback from neighborhoods or the driving community? Let's start with you, Marta.
Sure. Well, no one from SFMTA is here to defend themselves, but I do want to give...
Which, unfortunately, we weren't able to do.
But I want to give credit to the MTA and a lot of hardworking, smart, dedicated people there who are trying to get more innovative stuff on the streets. And it can be a real uphill battle in a city with many hills. So I think we have to be real about the local politics aspect of all this, too. And cranky neighbors, again, it goes back to that. Like, I don't want that parking space removed when we know that at an intersection, if you remove the parking spots at the very closest spot, you dramatically, immediately improve safety for everyone at the intersection, pedestrians, bicyclists, people driving, because everybody can see everybody better. And the city's pushing forward with that's called daylighting in a much more aggressive approach. And we've had a lot of people stand up to say, I'm sorry, but a parking spot is not worth someone's life. Like, and I think that's what I think there's a lot of good folks at MTA who are working hard. And I think we have a lot of elected officials at this moment, especially, who are really understanding this and ready to do more, be more aggressive and push. And Supervisor Haney has, you know, especially what he's seen in his district this year, has been such a champion. My question, but also my hunch, is that I think the people of San Francisco are ready for more aggressive changes. I think if you've lived here for any amount of time, you are seeing and feeling the safety issue on your streets on a daily basis. I have two young children, and I can't believe what I mean, I was just saying before, I was like, I'm feeling burned out from just having to approach every intersection with absolutely no faith that anyone's going to stop for me, and to feel defensive constantly. And I don't think that's the city we want to be. I don't feel like that's the values of San Francisco. And I think so many people I talk to who have nothing to do with my work, these are casual conversations, people really feel like the streets have changed and something, it's time for, we're ready for more aggressive changes on the streets to address this.
And I want to bring this question up because I imagine there's someone out there thinking this question. Everyone has some part to play in these injuries and deaths. Pedestrian behaviors, texting, looking at their phones, being distracted with headphones, does that contribute to this as well? And not to the exclusion of the other things we've been talking about, but I'm sure someone's thinking that out there and saying, what are we doing to get pedestrians to be wiser?
Yes. On social media, this is where I get to hear those comments and think about those and respond to them. And this is coming from me, I'm your role model pedestrian out there. I am as cautious as possible and as responsible as possible. And I think most people are, because we want to be safe. We know that it's a risky behavior just crossing the street. Now, we've had multiple people this year be hit and killed, again, in the crosswalk with a walk sign, you know, including a 14-year-old girl. Like, to me, it's like something's going on in our city when this is happening. This is not about whether a pedestrian is looking at their phone or not, which, by the way, was not involved in any of these. And the research that's being done nationwide, because frankly, there is a pedestrian blaming situation that happens in crashes where there's no data out, and that can be, it's like, oh, well, they were, you know, there's no research. The research that's being done has shown that they're not, distracted walking is not contributing to crashes.
Megan, I want to get you in before we take some calls and emails. What's your take on the fact that we're just not putting enough energy into this to do it fast enough and broadly enough, like Roger is saying?
Yeah, I mean, I have to be honest that I'm actually really inspired by my colleagues and their dedication that I get to work with every day. There's a lot of really passionate, smart people that I get to work with at SFMTA, in the police department and within the city family that are really committed to saving lives and are frankly devastated with every fatality that we see on our streets. And, you know, with the leadership of the mayor and the Board of Supervisors, our MJs implemented a quick build program this year, you know, committing to 15 projects that are being accelerated to address these issues, committed to 20 miles of protected bike lanes in the next 2 years, and also have just completed within the frame of this quick build what can be done in the near term, signal retiming improvements throughout the south of Market and north of Market. But I also wanted to, which also included daylighting, which is parking removal near intersections to increase visibility to protect pedestrians, but also to... Roger's earlier analogy regarding vaccination, I think, from a public health perspective, I cannot not touch that analogy. But I think also, you know, again, back to Vision Zero's transformative policies, which are things that we need state legislative authority to implement in San Francisco, including lowering speed limits and not using what's the 85th percentile rule, which is essentially that speeds are set based on how fast, the 85th percentile drivers are driving. And an analogy my colleague likes to use is it's like setting your teenager's curfew for the time he gets home every night. And so with respect to those types of improvements, which have the impact to impact not only our high injury network, but really the culture of speed in our entire city, those are things that are being studied now at the state level.
And they're not in the local control,
they're
right?
They're not in our local control. Similarly with automated speed enforcement, these are powerful tools that could really help us move the needle, but right now they're not in our local.
But the state needs to... how about our friend Gavin? What is he saying about these things?
Well,
we're still waiting to find out.
We are encouraged that the essentially Vision Zero's baby sister, the pedestrian strategy, was the result of then Mayor Newsom's executive directive on pedestrian safety. So, we'll see.
We just don't know yet.
Were you referring to the bill that's on his desk right now?
Tell us more about that.
Okay, so SB 127, I think, is the number. It's actually waiting for his signature, and I think if it goes until the 13th, I think it is, it'll become law. But it's basically going to require Caltrans, the state transportation agency, to consider what we call, I mean, this is jargony, but vulnerable road users, pedestrians and cyclists when they design roads, which they were supposedly doing already, but I know in the stories I covered, no, they're not. Their consideration of a cyclist is you put a little stripe along the drainage ditch and you say, look, a bike lane. I also wanted to say I'm not meaning to condemn everybody in the city bureaucracies. That's very far from what I meant to say. I do realize there's a hell of a lot of heroes at the city agencies working very hard to try and implement a lot of the things that I'm advocating for, too, and that we're all advocating for. This is also, as Megan was saying, I mean, this is a national and a state problem as well.
Well, it sounds like there's a disconnect, but potentially maybe that's changing from what you said about Mayor Breed, between the city, the rank and file city workers and what they're trying to achieve and sort of what's the political pressures. And does it take someone to say, we're going to put this aside and do something different. Mm-hmm. I want to reintroduce the program again. It's City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about the safety or lack thereof of our city's streets with Megan Weir, co-chair of the Vision Zero Safe San Francisco Task Force, Marta Lindsay, communications director at Walk SF, and Roger Rudick, editor of Streets Blog San Francisco. We have a couple of phone lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us also at cityvisions@klw.org. So let's go first to Starchild. Welcome to the program. Hello, are you there? Did we lose Starchild?
Can you hear me?
Yes, now we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. I was having a terrible time hearing the show. I'm listening on the phone anyway, so hopefully you can hear me better than I can hear you.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've basically been native. I've been in the city itself since 1995, and I agree, traffic's gotten worse. I get around. I don't own a car. I have a bicycle. That's the main way I get around. But I think that a lot of the stuff, the changes they've done to the streets have actually increased the congestion, and a lot of things they're doing to try to make the problem better are actually making it worse. Like before they tore down the freeway overpass over Market Street, you know, I used to be able to go up and down Market on my bike and rarely have to stop at that intersection. Now I have to stop there almost every time. There's always a ton of cars going back and forth on street level, and crazily, they don't allow people to make a right turn onto the freeway from Market Street going eastbound. So people trying to get onto the freeway have to drive several additional blocks, you know, or more, depending how hard they have to look for finding the entrance to get onto the freeway. But it's at least several blocks if they know the way. And, you know, that as opposed to simple right turn, that's just like putting more congestion on the street. And I think that this whole Vision Zero thing is, I mean, not only is it unrealistic, but it's just like the wrong priority. I mean, one of your guests mentioned that it's like a 100-year low for traffic fatalities in San Francisco, 2017 and 2018. Yet, you know, we're like at record highs for the amount of homelessness. Like people die every year on the street from being homeless because the city government is not allowing enough housing to be built because they're pandering to NIMBYs. And they're you know, it's so difficult and expensive and so many delays to get anything built. And so you got all the
Starchild, I appreciate your point, and we want to bring it back to Vision Zero because that's tonight's topic. So what would you recommend?
I wanted to draw the contrast there between, okay, well, you know, you could spend this much money on traffic calming or whatever to try to, you know, pursue this magical target of zero traffic fatalities, or you could put the money somewhere, you know, or not even put the money somewhere, but just take away some of the regulation that'll actually save more lives. I just feel like the whole policy is A, unrealistic, and B, misdirected.
Okay. Thanks so much for your comments. So I'm going to get reaction from our guests here. I saw your hand first, Roger, and then Megan.
I'm not really sure where to begin, but Vision Zero is achievable. And what I mean by that is I think there's a misunderstanding here that means that no one is – there's never going to be a car crash someday, that there's never going to be anyone injured. It's a phrase to describe what they have already accomplished in a lot of countries. Vision Zero is a Scandinavian concept. As I mentioned, I'm familiar with the Netherlands. You know, we would be looking at a handful of serious injuries every now and again, rather than it being something that we're reading about, you know, every couple of weeks someone getting killed horribly in San Francisco. So Vision Zero is absolutely achievable. I mean, we know how to do it. If we could wave a magic wand and bust away all the political obstacles, we would have a very safe city tomorrow. I mean,
how about the issue of congestion and that the way that the streets are currently being redesigned or, you know, getting onto the highway, creating congestion, perhaps getting motorists upset, and then they sort of, you know, they speed. I don't know exactly what Starchild was getting at, but that's kind of a scenario I can imagine.
I mean, we're not turning Octavia back into a freeway. We're not putting the Embarcadero freeway back. That's just not going to happen. We have a much greater population, so even if we did put them back, I think traffic would be pretty much as it is now, no matter what we did. There's a concept which is very counterintuitive, but the evidence is pretty damn strong, called induced demand. And every time you widen roads, build more freeways, you promote more driving.
If you build it, they will come.
Yeah, exactly. And you just end up right where you started, except you have worse pollution, more fatalities, more crashes, and a very unpleasant city to live in.
So, Megan, I'm going to ask you to address that tension that Starchild brought up. Like, where should the priorities be? Should it be on decreasing traffic injuries and deaths, or on decreasing deaths of homeless individuals?
Sure. So the longer I've worked on Vision Zero, the more clear it is to me that they're all interrelated. And so with respect to Vision Zero and congestion, ultimately, in order to achieve Vision Zero, we need to increase, we need to reduce driving. We need to increase walking and biking and transit use to get more people out of their cars into sustainable transportation modes. And then you're also less likely to injure people. But in order to do that, we need safer conditions on our streets in the first place so that more people are inclined to do that. With respect to homelessness, 20% of our fatalities last year were people who were homeless. So we are seeing clear intersectionality with respect to who's the most vulnerable in our society are the same people that are most vulnerable on our transportation network. So these aren't distinct issues. You know, creating safer streets protects everyone, and you know, including our homeless population. We need more affordable housing. Affordable housing helps address those issues.
All right. I want to get in some more calls here. Let's go next to Anne. Anne, welcome to the program.
Oh.
Are you there?
Hi, I'm in a... Oh, okay.
Oh, you probably have your radio on. Turn it off for us. Thanks.
Actually, I've got my speakerphone, headphones on. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I love this intersectionality conversation. I'm very concerned about the climate, and I'm also the wife of someone who was severely injured on a bike on Monterey Boulevard. And I just think that we're thinking, in some ways, we're even thinking too small, because I'm coming at this first from the perspective of the climate. I mean, we really, transportation is such a big chunk of our carbon footprint. I think that we really need to make the city primarily for transit, walking, and cycling, and other forms of transportation that are not only safer but low carbon. And I think that we need to make driving a car in the city somewhat akin to getting a handicap placard. That you need to have, we need to flip the script. It's not a right that you need to have a special reason to, essentially endanger people or contribute to the carbon footprint of the city in order to drive. And I think that's obviously a cultural shift, but I think that when you're setting goals, if you don't have, like you say, a vision, you're not ever going to get there. So I'm very much in favor of a drastic shift along the lines of what everyone been talking about, because my husband's injury, everyone, well, except for the driver who may have been drinking, but basically everyone was doing sort of, they weren't over the speed limit, my husband was in the right place on the road on this bike, it was just a bit of inattention.
Yeah.
Actually hanging up a hands-free cell phone. So I'm very much in the radical perspective, and am also as politically active as I can be. But I think those of us, people who are listening and thinking, where do I fit in? Going to your supervisors, going to meetings, being out there. We got to get a critical mass.
Thank you literally. So much for your call. I want to bring in one more caller here. Let's go to Carmen. Carmen, welcome to the program. Carmen?
Yes. Hello, could you hear me?
Yes, Carmen, we can hear you. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment is this. I walk to work every day. I mean, I'm working by downtown San Francisco, and I have two kids, and they walk home from school. I think that the worst, most perilous drivers everywhere is the Lyft and Uber drivers. And I don't know what kind of licenses they get, but I've seen them make U-turns. I've seen them go in the wrong way streets. Talk about little left and right turns. I'm always on Howard and First. I'm about to get driven off. My daughter goes to SOTA, and I drive her there, and they drive through not even looking at the walk. I mean, I think that there needs to be a much better regulation with Lyft and Uber drivers in regards to they should have a special type of license. And I know that a lot of the people who work, and I am foreigner, but a lot of them have been here for a little bit. They don't even know very well the traffic things, and I don't even know how they got the driver's license, because the way they drive is terrible.
Thank you so much, Carmen, for your comments. I want to actually echo Carmen's comments. We got a couple of emails. One from Stefan says, I ride a bike every day through the Mission District. To me, the number one hazard is Lyft and Uber drivers stopping suddenly in the bike lanes to pick up riders or making wild U-turns to do the same. What is happening on the education and law enforcement front to address this problem? And another email regarding Lyft from Cliff. The planning and bicycles for hire are just window dressing for a huge increase of Lyft drivers choking our streets and driving dangerously. As a pedestrian, I have no faith that the supervisors PTC I'm not sure what that refers to. And Bicycle Coalition can solve pedestrian deaths. They are bought and sold by Lyft, which was a huge influence on policy. Just try and oppose Lyft on anything and you will find out. So I know, Marty, you want to respond to that those calls about Lyft and Uber, and perhaps also weave in Cliff's comment there.
Whew, yeah, a lot to discuss. And I'm going to start. I'll start with the Uber and Lyft question, concern, whatever you want to call it. I think those feelings are real, and we know that 50% of congestion in the past years is from Uber and Lyft vehicles. So I think that actually links with one of our previous comments too. This congestion isn't because of safe street design. It's because there's more vehicles on the streets, dramatically more. We also know there's many more delivery vehicles because of things like Amazon. So we have all these many thousands more vehicles on our streets every day, Uber and Lyft vehicles. We know that 71% of those drivers are from outside of the city. They don't always know the streets. Some of those drivers are not driving safely. We know this from SF Police Department records of downtown traffic citations, that a very high number of them are going to Uber and Lyft drivers. And unfortunately, these companies are incentivizing their drivers to do more trips to get the bonus. I mean, they frankly baked into it is aggressive driving sometimes. That's deeply upsetting to me on a personal level. And we got to talk about Proposition D on the San Francisco ballot that no one is talking about yet. I don't even feel like anybody knows about it. And people just got their ballots. You can early voting started today. You can go to City Hall and vote right now for Prop D, which is it's a business tax on Uber and Lyft. Many cities already have this in place. Chicago, Portland, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Seattle, New York, for trips that originate outside of the city and go into the city. All these cities have done this already, and we now have the chance to do this in San Francisco.
It's a tax on the companies or on the people who are taking the rides?
It's the fee is on the ride. That's how it's based. Who pays it is that's unclear at this point, but amount
likely to be passed on, I imagine, to the person taking the ride, but we don't know.
Yeah, so if you were taking a shared ride in a Uber or Lyft, it would likely average 10 to 20 cents for your ride. For a more average distance solo ride, it would be 40 to 60 cents added to that ride. Again, to the company, it's a fee that this all gets.
And where would that money go?
So that's for us why we are so excited about Proposition D and hope all of you vote for it immediately. Half of the money goes to Vision Zero projects. And there is a big funding gap for these. You know, part of the puzzle or the whatever we've been talking about here is the funding. These are not cheap projects when you're redesigning streets. And there's already been identified large funding gaps with the San Francisco City, you know, for transportation forecasting. Mm-hmm. And this will help address that.
But not likely to slow down the amount of people signing up to be Uber and Lyft drivers or those taking those rides?
Oh, I don't.
That was not the intention.
We've had people say to us, "Well, I don't think Prop D goes far enough because it's not going to change the number of vehicles on the street."
But it'll get you that funding that you need for these improvements that we've been talking about,
and to make transit better. Half the money goes to SFMTA for hiring those bus drivers that we desperately need and improving service on the bus, which has taken a major hit because of all the people who are taking Uber and Lyft.
I want to get in the last 5 minutes of the program a couple of other concepts that have come up. One is this quick build concept. Mm-hmm. Is that something you want to talk a little bit more about, Megan? Very briefly, tell us why it's different in terms of the mechanics of how it's being implemented, not necessarily what's being done. And why, and do you think this is going to help us? And maybe, Roger, you could also step in on that. And then wanted to talk a little bit about congestion pricing. So let's try to get those couple of topics in before the end of the hour. Megan, do you want to get us started?
Sure. So with respect to quick builds, again, this is an SFMTA program, so I'm able to speak at it at a high level. But what it really does is responds to, you know, the reality that often delivering a comprehensive, you know, corridor project can take years. So what the quick builds do are really implementing reversible safety measures, quickly. So these are things like the paint post signal timing, which is often invisible but can have tremendous safety improvements with respect to increasing crossing.
Like getting
times,
the walk sign to turn before the green light turns.
Exactly.
Like that's an example of that.
Those types of things.
Right, to give the head start to the pedestrians.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
So the Quick Build project is targeted on our city's high injury network. So again, that 13% of streets where 75% of severe and fatal crashes are concentrated, and SFMTA is rolling out 10 this year and 5 more next year.
Mm. So Roger, this sounds like it's like trying to get rid of the red tape and move something to go through faster. Why is it taking us so long to get to this? I could see a lot of other city processes really benefiting from quick X, whatever it would
yeah,
be.
Yeah.
Right? Is it going to work? What do you think?
It's mysterious to me, you know, why it was always necessary to do so many outreach meetings to do something as simple as stripe a bike lane. But that has been the case historically. So now I think 7th Street, they were able to do in about 6 months. I think they did a couple outreach meetings. They put a protected bike lane in. And then I went to look at what they did, and I thought it was awful. But so we still have a gap in the engineering that's getting done. And I hope that Prop D will get us the money to do things better. 7th Street, I did a very critical piece because they did little plastic straws with a very narrow bike lane, and it felt dangerous as hell because you're right next to traffic and motorists were – I mean, I just went to check it out once, and I watched a motorist drive over all the safe hit posts. Those are those little plastic posts that people see going up all around the city. So we can do things faster. I hope we'll do things right, though.
Mm-hmm. And then congestion pricing. Who wants to summarize where we are with that? That's been up. And out there for
that
a long time.
That could be its own topic.
True. But I'm curious, why we have not made any movement on that? Who wants to take that question? Okay, Roger, go ahead.
I feel like in the United States and in San Francisco as well, we sort of have this sense of entitlement. You're a motorist, I get to drive where I get to drive. But it has costs. And the costs we've been discussing as far as injuries and people getting killed, but also as far as congestion. The caller was complaining about congestion. Well, the one thing that has actually worked to reduce congestion, and they've done this in Stockholm, they've done it in central London, is you charge people to go into highly congested areas. And then all of a sudden they say, oh, wait a minute, do I really need to make this trip? Maybe I'll go the other direction to do the errand or the shopping or the job that I need to get to. And you sort of even out the traffic burden substantially, which reduces pollution, which reduces most of the problems we've been talking about.
Mm. Great.
But you got to get over that hurdle of accepting it.
Megan, go ahead.
Yeah, and congestion pricing is one of our transformative policies because we've seen in places like London where it's been implemented significant fatality and severe injury reductions, and also the opportunity for investments in safety as the policy generates revenue.
And then just quickly, the Better Market Street, which is going to try to really extend the amount of Market Street that is just not open to private vehicles. Is that going to help us, do you think, Marta?
So this is going to be voted on Tuesday next week by the San Francisco MTA Board of Directors, and this would remove private vehicles from essentially the ferry building all the way to Octavia Street.
But not the Uber and Lyft drivers, right?
No, it removes
them. Yes, it removes Uber
them.
And Lyft
not
drivers.
Taxis,
yes,
though.
Not
absolutely.
Taxis, okay.
Not taxis, but it would just otherwise people, buses. And we are pushing hard for this to happen. People have been fighting for this for many years. And to me, this goes to that the caller talking about the climate. What kind of city are we going to be? The only city that is going to be able to address the climate change issue and actually have a transportation system that is sustainable is going to have to start making our cities for people first. And having these car-free spaces, having congestion pricing, this San Francisco is a huge city. We can't just have more and more and more vehicles. It's not working for anybody, I don't think. So these tools are not scary. I think they're going to blow our minds and make us just like love San Francisco even more if we can make them happen.
Well, we got to stop there. Thanks to Megan Weir of Vision Zero SF, Marta Lindsay of Walk SF, and Roger Rudick of Streets Vlog San Francisco. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Dave LaTulipe. We welcome back our producer this evening, Chris Nooney, and tune in next Monday as we listen back to my conversation conversation from earlier this year with San Francisco's city librarian Michael Lambert, and join my co-host Ethan Alkine in 2 weeks as he sits down with San Francisco planning director John Rahame. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.